Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on our grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, depth. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats, football history and its memorabilia on the Sports History Network, in conjunction with Spook Enterprises. And we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 100-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. At this time, I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larger. He hails from Portland, Oregon, the one and only Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show today.
Captain, good to see you again, sir. It's been a week or so.
It's been a few days since our last show. And Joe, I'm going to start off by congratulating you on your Super Bowl victory of a few weeks ago from what looked like a very, very timid New England Patriots team, echoing many, many different miscues on the gridiron. And it was an exceptionally rough game to watch if you were not a Seahawks fan, and even more difficult if you were a Patriots fan. I, not being either one, but rooting for you, well, I was happy with the outcome.
Well, so you're a closeted Seahawk. In the same way I root for the Packers if the Seahawks aren't playing.
I appreciate that.
My good friend, Bob Swick is a Packer fan. I'm sure you're going to give it the edge. I mean, although, Jeff Payne is a, Patriots fan, so you're probably, that's why you're so quiet. You didn't want to upset either one of us by picking us.
Yeah. Well, again, it was... it was a Seattle game from step one. New England just did not. New England didn't look prepared for the game. That was my opinion.
Yeah, defense wins games, but I mean, trust me, I didn't breathe a sigh of relief until the couple minutes left. I mean, I think it was 9-0 at halftime, or maybe 12.
Right.
That's not a comfortable lead that you're happy with. I mean, one touchdown and suddenly you're biting your fingernails again. So, I mean,
I just thought from step go, New England just did not look on their game in any way, shape or form.
Yeah.
And I think they were overwhelmed with the situation. They were overwhelmed being there. I don't think they responded in the second half in any way, shape or form to what happened in the first half. They didn't make any adjustments in my opinion. And it was a blowout victory, in my opinion, for the Seattle Seahawk franchise.
Yeah, I can't believe we haven't talked since the victory, the Seahawks Super Bowl win. Because, I mean, I'm sure the listeners have picked up on this, but, we have a text chain. There's about 10 of us on it, maybe a dozen, right, from a vintage football. I think it's called Football Nerds or something like that. Self-deprecating humor. I mean, and we communicate on that so much. Sometimes it gets a blur between, when I get to catch up with you and when I'm texting. I went to a card show here in Portland over the weekend, and I'm obviously making fun of Bob by sending pictures of all the Pokemon being sold at
Right.
the show.
right?
And
And so the Pokemon, so that's something I'd like to touch base with you. You were at the show, and my phone was inundated with the Pokemon dealer.
inundated, the little big of a bit of an adjective there.
I was very overwhelmed by it. I brought back,
I'll meet you halfway, flooded.
I was brought back to the memories of my last show in Wilmington. Hockey, that was, and that was the last show I've done now in a long time. And so basically, it's there too. And
Bob, what kind of friend would I be if I wasn't poking you at the things that you find irksome? I mean, come on, that's what friends are for.
it was crazy. We were in the local Walgreens drugstore the other day, and I'm looking at the news the magazine rack, and there's a line of Pokemon Time magazines in a row, and I'm like, come on, wait, this is crazy. It's absolutely crazy. So I think this is going to unfortunately end up being a really bad bubble
I hear
down
you.
the road.
Well,
So
I look forward to in the near distant future when we have somebody on the show who's a Pokemon expert to discuss the latest and greatest. But
that's
that's
not going to be happening in a long time.
our Pokemon overlords taking over the hobby.
So did you actually see any vintage or any
I did, yeah. There were a couple. It was really crowded. Like I was there with a friend and my daughter. My friend's like, "Is this a normal show?" I'm like, "They make the halls a little wider, at the National. Like, you can
Right.
walk down one looking at someone and turn around. There's room enough in the middle for people to be doing what they want." But man, it was, it was packed. And there's a lot of people who are not aware of their surroundings, standing in the middle of the already crowded aisle with their suitcase
Right.
and stuff. And yeah, I think I lasted about 45 minutes there. I'm like, "All right, I'm ready to go get a coffee."
You can imagine the frustration of those same people with their suitcases in front of your table, discussing their latest Pokemon buys and/or put their stuff on your table, on your stuff, especially your vintage stuff. And politely, by the end of the day, I was kind of exhausted saying, "Hey guys, you got to move someplace else."
Imagine a furious captain. These two kids are probably middle-aged adults. Like, "Hey, do you mind if I move this gridiron, whatever it's called, magazine out of the way so that I can set my Pokemon stuff here?
Yeah.
We need an official interpretation. I say Pokemon, and you say Pokeman. So I
Yeah,
mean,
it's I know it's Pokemon, but the
oh."
Swickisms that I come up with
Like,
I have to call it something that it's
I
not.
agree. It's akin to George Bush calling him Saddam Hussein, and every time he said it, there was a little bit of a yeah. I like
Exactly.
it. So, all
Exactly.
right, I love it. Great shirt, by the way.
Thank you. That's our very, very old vintage Gridiron Greats magazine shirt. And if you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats magazine,
What are you waiting for?
gridirongreatsmagazine.com. A
Nice
couple,
plug. Great plug, Captain.
do you have any auction news? I was curious. We were talking about, I forgot which auction it was.
Oh, Heritage just had a
Yeah.
sale. Their Heritage ended on Sunday. There's a 73 Topps football wax pack box in there I
That's
want.
what it was. Okay. Yep.
I'll admit, we had some friends over dinner and and a couple of bottles of wine between the six of us. And by the time they left and I cleaned the kitchen. I went to go check the auction, and it had ended. It ended a little early, so
Okay.
I got blanked on that. But I was
All right.
tracking. They had a bunch of Super Bowl rings in there. They probably
Yeah, I
had
saw
20.
that. I saw that. Yeah.
So I saved watching a bunch of them because I wanted to see, just out of curiosity, what ring, what team went for, the most. Because obviously, the provenance of where the ring came from, they give rings to the. To the back office person.
Right.
If a ring went to the guy who does who's the team dentist, it probably sells for a little less than the running back, who started the game. So I was a little curious about that. So I have about 20 of them saved. I was going to put that into a little spreadsheet and look at
Okay.
the who, when, why, where, and price, and just check it
Right.
out.
Right. You're seeing, I think what I've seen lately, not lately, probably the past 2 years, are the lesser people who got the rings, obviously have gotten older, what they're going to do with the rings, so on and so forth. So they're putting it up for auction. I have a feeling over the next 5 years, there's going to be a lot more Super Bowl rings going to auction. I also believe there's going to be a lot more Super Bowl programs and ticket stubs coming to auction at the same time, as a lot of collectors are maturing now, getting up in the years. They're saying, I'm not going to keep this. Let me get it out on the market. And then traditionally, your number ones to 13 are going to be the most in demand and probably drive the greatest prices for them at the same time. So we'll
curious
see.
Why you think you'll see more Super Bowl rings. That Heritage auction was the most Super Bowl rings I'd seen at any one offering.
Right.
So
right.
That would be the
right.
front of the tsunami, yeah.
I got a feeling that a lot of them are coming out. And again, I don't think it's a good idea, and this is just me, and I have no say other than my own opinion. It's not a good idea to flood an auction with 7,
Oh,
8, 9, 10 rings. That doesn't
totally
make
agree.
any sense whatsoever.
Totally
That
agree.
hurts the consignee who's trying to get maximum amount of cash for what they have. It's not a good idea. So again, this is where I feel very strongly REA, Robert Edwards Auctions, and our friend Brian Dwyer does very well by, you know, limiting what is actually in an auction. And
Totally agree.
it's a theme of a particular collector.
Who knows? Super Bowl ring collector is probably a very thinly
Oh, they are. They are.
Market. So, I mean, yeah, putting a whole bunch of them out there does seem like too much. But, I mean, who knows? Maybe that was one consigner
Right,
who
right. And I got a feeling that that's
maybe
what
thought it was better to put them all out at once. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all nerds. I mean, I'm
Well,
not wagging my finger at the nerd who collects Super Bowl rings, but I don't know that industry.
And it's more common for a Super Bowl ring collector to collect his or her team. So, say
Totally.
if a Packers ring comes up, that's a hot commodity. If a
Totally
Steelers
agree.
comes up, so on and so forth. You know, so I think that's part of what might have happened in that particular auction.
Couldn't agree with you more. Like, I would buy a Super Bowl ring for the right price, Seahawk ring, if it was a player, you know, not a you know, yeah, not a back office person, because they're inscribed now. I mean, on the back is, you know, who it went to.
Right.
I just think it'd be cool to, you know, just wear that around. Maybe go to Hawaii for the, you know, for the, you know, Pro Bowl game and wear
Yeah.
that around town. You know, people might mistake me for Gronkowski or something.
Exactly. All right. Our special guest is here, and I'd like to introduce him, and we'll get into our show today. He graduated from Hillsdale College and Notre Dame Law School and practiced law in South Bend, Indiana for 41 years. Even while a student, he started developing a notable collection of political and presidential memorabilia. As a result of living in South Bend, he became increasingly fascinated with Notre Dame football and history. Opportunities to acquire some very unique pieces over 30 years ago really piqued his engagement and honed focus towards the best of early Notre Dame football memorabilia, particularly that associated with Newt Rockne. When an extensive collection of Newt Rockne was sold by the family in 1995, dozens of museum-quality pieces scattered into the market. At that time, he recognized a unique opportunity, and ever since, he's been trying to round up as many of the better items of that collection. Retirement allowed him the time to actively further research Rockne history and actively pursue collecting. That resulted in the publication of the book Men, Moments, and Myths in 2021 that allowed collectors and fans to see dozens of unique artifacts and to read the history associated with them. That book has just been updated in the form of a second edition and now contains more than 100 images of artifacts, many of them one of a kind and never before seen. A companion website to the book showing images from the collection, directing people to a 9-episode podcast series on the life of legacy of Rockne, and providing people the opportunity to hear audio clips of Rockne, has just been launched this week. You'll be able to find it at rockneandmore.com. It's at this time I have the honor to welcome Mr. Andy Dickel to the show. Andy, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
Outstanding.
Nice to have you on. It's an honor to have you on. We've seen some amazing stuff Prior to this show that we were preparing for a script and preparing for showing our audience. So let's get
Impressive.
down to business and our first question. If you could tell our audience how you got interested in collecting Newt Rockne material.
I'm a collector by disease or by nature. And somehow I started gravitating to sports at a certain point in time, and it was kind of eclectic. And then I started finding some opportunities to pick up Notre Dame pieces living in South Bend. And then I became a more avid Notre Dame football fan. And the uniqueness of Notre Dame's history and its legends and characters just kind of draws you in. And I was drawn in. And when some unique pieces surfaced, it was an opportunity I thought that was very special. And you mentioned it in the introduction. In 1995, the Rockne family sold an unbelievable collection that they'd kept for over 60 years after Newt had passed
Wow.
or died. And I wasn't prepared to deal with all that at the time when it hit the market. And it went in ultimately to an auction and it scattered every which way. I'll back up just one second and say that the family tried to get it sold different ways. Ultimately, it went to a dealer in Chicago. And that dealer thought the most obvious thing was for this that collection to belong where? At Notre Dame.
Right.
And
Right.
he went to Notre Dame archives, and like many university archives and things, they made it very clear, we don't buy anything. See you later, buddy. And he said, I almost felt guilty or dirty. And so he went back and put up his own auction of the whole collection, and I bought probably 100 lots,
Yeah.
and the thing scattered. So anyway, after that, I was kind of hooked in because I picked up a few pieces there, but I was on the hunt for the major ones after that for many years.
Wow. What a story. What you stated about the universities, that was the same experience I had with Yale University, with some very old memorabilia that I handled many, many years ago. And they were the same thing. We do not buy anything. And I just was amazed hearing that. And just as a real brief aside, head coach Carm Khoza of Yale University, football coach for many, many years, he was the iconic head coach of Yale football. His entire collection of memorabilia went at a tag sale that the family had for 3 days at his house in Orange, Connecticut. And I was just so mortified when I caught it. I saw it and I got there. Some of the pieces were sold, other pieces were not sold. I picked up a few pieces and I just said to myself, what an absolute shame. The man who really represented Yale football for over 30 years, we're at a tag sale selling his stuff. And Yale did not do anything whatsoever with it. So that makes my blood boil. And I share your frustrations. With Notre Dame, I personally am glad you took it upon yourself to hold probably one of the most historical collections of football items from this gentleman, from Newt Rockne, which is incredible.
Well, the dealer was, I don't know if you're familiar with, it was a sports collector store in Chicago.
Right,
It was Quinn and Steinbach.
right,
And
right.
they told me later that what they wanted to sell or offered to sell to Notre Dame for, and they turned down and shooed him out of town, literally. He ran
Right.
his own auction, and he said, I was blown away by the interest in Notre Dame stuff, which I
Right.
is unimaginable to me. He said, I sold it for five times more than Notre
Right.
Dame chased me out of town for.
I actually remember that auction from 1995. I remember he
Oh,
advertised in
wow.
Sports Collector's Digest. He's a good guy. I mean, he was up and up, and he ran auctions for years. So I could see his frustration. But then again, he made out. He did well with it one way or the other.
Is that pretty normal? I've heard about that about the Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame doesn't buy things.
Right. They
I
don't.
didn't know that
But
about the group.
here the strange thing was, if they were astute at all they had to do was go find a donor, a supporter, an alum
Right.
or two, and say, hey, would you please buy this collection
Right.
and give it to us? But a lot of these places don't even think that way. They don't have that mentality. And what is too bad, I don't have everything rounded up, but I have most of the key items. But it was just amazing as a whole collection, it was spectacular, and it belonged in one place if it could. Right. The only benefit is I'm trying to share it with people, as we're talking about today, where many times when things go in archives, they go down in the basement of the organizations. A lot of people never see them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's exactly. The end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. So you were, Andy, you were able to purchase quite a few of the items 30 years ago in that auction in 1995? No.
30 years ago, I only purchased, the way the auction ran, if you remember these auctions, you had no internet then. They were phone auctions. And a lot would stay open for like 15 minutes after the last bid on that lot. So meanwhile, all the lesser lots are going away, and I'm holding out for two or three key items. I got two or three lesser items. I
don't gotcha. Know.
But I'm holding out for the watch. I'm holding out for the contract, holding out for the passport. It gets down, there's only like four or five that's left at midnight. And so Quinn gets us on the phone and says, hey, let's just get this over right here. I came up short on every one of them.
Oh, okay.
I got a case of the shorts on every one. The numbers were bigger than I was used to. They're still very modest in hindsight, but I'm at midnight home with a family and kids, and I'm thinking, okay, this is getting kind of crazy. And I had tremendous remorse when that closed.
Oh, yeah.
And so those scattered, and I've been on the hunt for them literally ever since.
Yeah. Yeah, we've all had that. You know, like that. Here's my Maginot line. I'm not going to bid above this. And then the auction ends. You're like, ah, damn it. Right. I would have gotten one more click. Yeah.
Well, the interesting story, one of the interesting stories is that watch I really wanted. I dropped out. I was the first underbidder, last underbidder. That thing surfaced 8 years later in another auction with, well, it was Bill Mastro. Mastro lumps in it a bunch of other things into one lot, which wow. Buyers like, sellers should not. With it came seven telegrams, including Newt's last telegram to Bonnie, the airline telegrams to her about the crash, Notre Dame's telegrams to her because she was in Florida after the crash. They just threw those in, didn't even picture them. So make a long story short here, I'll try to shorten it. I got the watch and the telegrams for less than they went for together with Quinn at the first
time. Wow.
Good for you.
Because the auctioneer just lumped them all in, and I didn't even fully appreciate what I was getting until I got them.
Boy, we've just been talking about in our football nerds thread about lazy auction houses who bother reaching out, because there was a, what was that Red Grange set, Bob, that sold?
The Spaldings?
Mayfair Candies.
Mayfair Candy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was an entire set, and they didn't bother asking anyone who was in it. They barely listed, I think, Red Grange. Anyway, right. just lazy. All you had to do was ask one football person or one collector, and you would have known what they had. It stuns me. So,
and collectors, and they look, some of these collectors look and they see like this telegram from Newt Tabani. I think you may even have it that you can.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
You let me know if you want me to put it up.
Yeah,
now.
Put that up. And that was just a throw in. It wasn't even pictured. And it's pretty special piece. These are the last known words of the coach to his wife just before he boards the plane that shortly thereafter crashes. And he basically signs a hugs and kisses Newt, or love and kisses Newt. And so to some of us and some of the serious collectors, and they look at that, that's a very special standalone piece.
Wow.
The highest order. And they just threw it as a toss in. So I was a beneficiary of some of those auction habits I never liked when I was a consigner.
Here you go.
This yeah, is there it is. So, I mean, that's a special piece to me.
That's incredible. Your website. I'm the one who spent the last couple hours on your website the last couple of days, because as with many guests, you know, who really love collecting esoteric things like this, it's like I knew Rockne had died in a plane crash. I had no idea the circumstances around it. So next thing you know, I'm on. You know, I'm looking at photos of the crash and this, I mean, and looking at newsreels from it and et cetera. So, I mean, as your website says, this is right before he boards a plane. He sends a telegram to his wife. I mean, this is the last thing ever spoken. Then he boards a plane that dies, where it crashes and dies. Leaving right now, we'll be at Biltmore, love and kisses. I've been married for 20 years. I don't talk to my wife like that. Love and kisses. That's incredibly affectionate. That shows the love that they had. I don't
So
know.
that plane crashed near Bazaar, Kansas, out in the middle of nowhere. There was no FAA then. There was nothing. And so part of what I've also been able to pick up, and they're out there, you can find them online, pictures of the crash site. People literally, some drove up in cars, some in horses, and they rummaged through the site. They picked up parts and wings and just walked away with it. There was no
It's
control of
sad.
the thing. And that just shows how much things changed and how early that was in the commercial airline business.
Sad that that happened. I read that too, where it's like, and I hate to say it, I look at that wristwatch, and is it okay if I bring that up?
Well, sure, because there's an interesting story about that too. A major auction house, I'd say is about 7 years ago, said they were auctioning off the wristwatch Newt Rockne was wearing when he died in the plane crash. Well, it wasn't. And even though I could document and show them why it wasn't right, just people know, be cautious of these auctions, they continued to run it. They put a minimum opening bid of $100,000, an estimate much higher. And they were selling a wristwatch or a watch that I believe was owned by Rockne, but it wasn't the one he wore when he died at the crash. And this one is documented because in the coroner's investigation that occurred after it, it specifically states found at the crash site was a personal watch of Mr. Rockne, and they described that engraving on the back, the engraving on the back, which is pictured here in this image you show. And so it's documented with the report from the coroner's inquest. And this watch was with the Rockne family until 1995 itself, too. So it was there. So,
I have to admit, this is a little macabre.
yep.
When I first read this, this was likely on Newt's wrist when he died in a fiery plane crash, and now here it is. So part of me is like, that's
Yep.
interesting. It's a part of history. It's definitely his. And the other part is, the how it became detached from him in the crash, because it was found, as you said, I read also it was found, at the crash near him.
And the crash was a terrible crash. I mean, nobody was all there when it was done. I mean, it was just a bad crash. And so they had trouble identifying people. Nothing survived that crash in very good shape. And I understand what you're saying about the macabre part of this. It's almost like when somebody has something of Lincoln when the night he went to booth at the theater. As time goes by, it's less macabre, if that makes any sense. I don't know if it
It
does,
does.
but yeah, I understand the thought, but it's still a pretty special piece.
There was a telegram on your website that I read where they asked his wife to come identify the body because they're like, it's not in very good shape, and we highly suggest a closed casket.
Yep.
So I mean, just a few little things I read, and looking at this. Like I said, I knew he died in a crash. I'd never looked into the how and who and how why, and just
This
that.
is really one of the maybe the first national crash with a figure in it like Rockne, and that's what drew attention to the whole airline industry and everything of investigating and reporting it. The one follow-up of this is interesting too. I don't think you have the image here. I've got the telegram from a guy named Jay Wyatt, who was with Spalding, and he immediately telegrams Bonnie Rockne, and his question is, would it be okay to broadcast the services? And she writes at the bottom of the telegram for it to go back that says, "Hey, it's up to Father O'Donnell, who's then the president of Notre Dame." Now, the story of that is they do broadcast it, and it is the first funeral ever nationally broadcast in the United States.
I listened to two of your podcasts last night on your website, the last two, and I thought that was interesting as well. The bells ringing every 30 minutes. Yeah, it was pretty interesting. So, I'm the one who drove all the traffic on your website, in case you get your reports.
Well, hey, it's nice. Thank you very much. Now,
Absolutely.
you have a just had some other images to pull up. If you don't mind me jump around, let me mention there's one that may not seem significant to people, but it is. Do you have the contract with Nebraska?
I beg your pardon, I do not. I went
Well,
through and I picked the stuff that
okay.
I
Well, let me
see.
just mention that in my book and things, I mentioned this contract with Nebraska. It's for a game. 1921. And why is that significant? One, it was neat to have a contract Newt Rockne signed to play a game with Nebraska. But the story behind it is what's special. Notre Dame couldn't get anybody of intersectional significance to ever come to South Bend. They had a very modest stadium, sat most of the time 13 to 15,000. They were wood bleachers, just like a high school. So they were traveling the country to play anybody of significance. Notre Dame went to Nebraska 6 straight years. They went to Lincoln 6 straight years for a football game. This contract is the first time he gets Nebraska to come to South Bend. And so it is the first major intersectional opponent to ever come to South Bend to play a game. And in the contract, it's interesting. Guess who gets the biggest share of the gate receipts?
Nebraska.
Nebraska. And in the contract, he commits to going back to Nebraska the next 2 years. So it just tells you where Notre Dame stood in the world in the 1920 era. Its opponents at that time still included people like Wabash, DePaul, Mount Union. Yeah. It also had some bigger opponents, even Army, but they had to travel. They were literally going on the road all the time because nobody would come to South Bend to play this little poor struggling school with a modest little stadium. And that contract was significant to me because that was the first time they could get an intersectional opponent to come, and it shows the business terms of what he had to give up to do it.
Wow.
Yeah, to come to someone's house, to come to someone else, the traveling team to get most of the gate receipts is that's a pretty tough pill to swallow.
The split wasn't that way when he went to Nebraska. Notre Dame didn't get the majority of the receipts.
Yeah,
I'm sure. It's an amazing story because, again, we look at, you know, where college football ended up today, which is in many cases a dramatically different game than he would ever even imagine. And look at Notre Dame. Look at the program. They actually have their own network for football games. And the
difference he made, if you look at the stadium he inherited and he was playing in, he finally got a new one built in his last year as coach, 1930. That is still the stadium they play in. 95 years later, he was playing in wood bleachers before that nobody would come to play. And he ends up getting built in 1930, a stadium designed by Osborne Engineering, the same people that did a lot of the Michigan Stadium and other major stadiums around the country. He got that built in South Bend, and then the people came.
Nice.
Unbelievable.
Do you want me to just throw up the stuff?
Sure, throw up some.
Yeah, let's go through the items. They're too rare not to look at and to hear the story behind them.
Yeah, very good point, Captain. Let me see here. Here is here's another one I found interesting. Are you, and I hate to ask this, are you, if I see, I apologize. I wasn't able to grab the images, so I did a screen grab. So I'm sorry if they're, I think I'm opening it with the wrong thing. Anyways.
What you've got there are the telegrams about the crash, correct?
Yes.
So there are two telegrams there. One is a notification telegram from the airline to let Bonnie Rockne know her husband died in a plane crash. And you might say, why are they sending her telegrams in 1931 when there were telephones?
Yeah.
They couldn't find her, I'm confident, because she wasn't in South Bend. The telegram still went to South Bend, but she was in Florida. And in that telegram, they just say, we regret to inform you, basically, that Newt Rockne died in the crash today. And it's pretty matter of fact with not much empathy or sympathy. If you scroll down the next one, it comes a day or two later, and it's from the president of the airline.
I didn't even notice that it was a couple of days later.
Yeah, and he's expressing 31st. he's expressing sympathy and consolation to it.
No wait a second, you're right. Actually, I didn't notice the dates on those. Of course, you're right.
Yeah. So one is just a formal notification, and the other one is one of sympathy. Wow. Interesting, it's very limited what you've recovered for wrongful death. The estate brought a claim against the airline. And I don't recall exactly, I think it was like $5,000, the most you could recover in wrongful death in the state of Kansas at that time. And they settled it for like $500 less as a voluntary settlement. And that's what they got for the plane crash.
Wow. Wow.
Wow. Boy, and just the circumstances. I mean, I hate to say it again, the rabbit hole I went down, the circumstances around it, where there's like a mechanic, who came out 30 years after the crash, who said he told them not to fly the plane because he could see the lamination of the wings separating. I mean, the wing fell off the plane and landed like a couple hundred yards behind the actual crash.
Those were wood frame wings at the
Wood
time.
frame wings,
Yeah,
yes.
yeah.
I mean, so you have a mechanic, a lot of deferred maintenance on a plane, a mechanic saying, hey, we probably shouldn't do this, but it was a mail plane, I think they were making a stop. Anyways, yeah, and for the wing to just tear off, yeah,
And
that's
so,
just, it's a sad,
in
yeah.
Rockne at the time, he wasn't on college business. Rockne was going to California on his own personal business. And so the Newt Rockne life is much more than a coach. He was there with the giants of the first ones to commercialize themselves. And that was Ruth, Gehrig, Dempsey, and Rockne. They were all represented by Christy Walsh, who was the main first real sports agent at the time. And Rockne had been in poor health. He spent the Christmas of 1930 in Mayo Clinic. Went to Florida to recover, but boy, he was back on the road again. He'd gone, made a trip earlier, and this was his second trip since then. He'd gone back up South Bend, then Chicago, then to Kansas City, and then he caught this flight. But he died on business, real personal business. The other thing, when you look at images of him, you'd think he's a much more senior man than he was. He had just turned 43.
Oh wow. Yeah, I saw that.
And all images make him look like he's 65.
I totally agree. I thought the same thing. I didn't know he was that young.
But he'd been in Mayo Clinic and over Christmas because of a total physical exhaustion and a breakdown. And they told him you have to give up things because he was traveling with that team was going coast to coast. In the summer, he was out on all coaching clinics and lectures all summer long. He was marketing products. He was traveling all the time. He was in his nature. He could not sit still. And he was gone. And they, at Mayo Clinic, the doctor basically told him, "You have to curtail your activities, or you're going to have a total collapse."
Here's a weird thing, Andy. One of the podcasts you had that they do a news clip, from the day, and he pronounces it Canute a
I think it's
couple times.
Canute.
Ooh, what is it? How is it?
It's
What's the problem?
Canute. He was Canute to his family. He was Canute to his closest, but it got kind of, I'll call it Americanized. But he was Canute, and that's how he wanted to be known. But it's even hard. I know it's Canute. It's hard to train yourself to say Canute.
Gotcha.
Wow.
Well, which leads us to the civil service application you were talking about
Okay,
before.
this is a great story.
I can zoom in on this too if there's a certain spot you want.
Well, let me see. He was at high school. He did not finish his senior year. He and some other guys got in a bit of trouble because they were running their track practices during school hours in a park, and the principal found them. And the principal excused him from the school, said he'd help him get into other high schools, and he opted not to do that. And you got to remember, we're talking 1907. He's an immigrant kid. He was very literate, quite frankly, and I'm sure his father probably said, "You know enough. It's time to go to work."
Enough.
And this application. Some many interesting things, and it told us things that nobody really knew before I saw this. One, he puts on this that his place of birth was Chicago, which it was not. He was born in Norway, but I presume he thought he wouldn't get a job with the U.S. Civil Service Commission, perhaps. But he also says in this, they ask him, "Would you be willing to work in the neighboring state?" Puts yes. "Would you be willing to work in the District of Columbia?" Puts yes. "Would you be willing to work?" And then they go to territories, and they put Hawaii was a territory then, and they put Puerto Rico, and he says yes. Think how history would have been different if Newt Rockne had been sent to Puerto Rico, or if Newt Rockne had gone to any other state. He stayed in Chicago, got the entry-level job, paid him $50 a month, and that's all he asked for. And this is $50 a month. But there's other pages, and I think you've just got one page here. There's others that show his exam, his geography exam. You and I couldn't pass it. It's just an amazing piece of thing. There's like 17 pages in this altogether. But now think about this: he's trying to get a job in 1907 as the lowest entry-level postal clerk, high school dropout. In 1988, the President of the United States flies to South Bend, Indiana, goes out to Notre Dame, and unveils a first-class postage stamp with whose name and image on it?
Canute.
Canute Rockne. I mean, what, it's just a great story. This guy was just trying to get a job, and he ends up being the face of a first-class postage stamp on the 100th anniversary of his birthday.
Unbelievable.
That is interesting.
As a collector, this piece is interesting to me because virtually nothing of him exists before he got to Notre Dame.
That's a good point. I'll stop sharing this one. It is it's so interesting just because I mean, like you said, if you're not a Notre Dame fan, I mean, there's it was so interesting to just read up about some of this. I don't know.
The history alone of early football with Newt Rockne, if you really put it in perspective, this stuff is just so incredibly rare and so historical. It's mind-boggling to me, and I'm just so happy that, it's been preserved because it is truly, a piece of history.
Totally
Right.
agree.
You've got up now his employment contract. He signed this in 1924 for $10,000 a year. The contract's one page. It doesn't even delineate his official titles or responsibilities. It's got some moral behavior type things you've got to adhere to and be a good steward to the students and those things. But a couple of sidelight stories. He signs this in, I think it was March. Is it March? Yeah, March of 24.
March 24,
They win the national championship that year. They play in the Rose Bowl in January, first of January in 25, being Stanford. He stays behind and negotiates. The people at Southern Cal talk him into staying behind, and they negotiate a deal to hire him as their coach. He just signed this 10-year contract. And the deal was they basically reached a handshake deal. He'd take the Southern Cal job. His wife liked Southern California area, supposedly. They were going to pay him a lot more money. And he wouldn't have to deal with some of the issues he had with his academic board and things at Notre Dame. The word of it leaked before he gets back to Notre Dame and it blows up. And so he gets back to South Bend. It was supposed to stay mum. He gets back to South Bend with tail between his legs because he's got this 10-year contract and no ability to figure his way out of it. And so he gets his ears kind of pinned back a bit. But then go forward, it's like another year or two later, Christy Walsh has got him in Columbia. Negotiating with them, and there apparently was even something signed at Columbia, and for him to go there, and that leaked out again before he got back to South Bend. And at that time, the Notre Dame president said, "Hey, you want out? I'll let you out. But right now, you look terrible because you've broken your contract with us, and now you've got Columbia in a crosshairs, and you've embarrassed them." And Rockne said no, he'd stay there, and the coach then they kept Notre Dame kept him. But he got his ears pinned back seriously then. He lost. You can find some correspondence where he told people, I can't offer you the job I did a few months ago. I don't have all the same authorities I had. And the stadium he wanted to get built, which he was talking to him then in 25 and 26, got pushed back to 1930.
I had
So
no
this
idea.
contract's pretty neat. It was a 10-year contract, and he ended up living by it. But there were a couple bumps in the road. He was a very hot commodity, and people wanted him, and they were offering him a whole lot more money than Notre Dame would.
That's so interesting. You think of Newt Rockne and, like integrity, honor. I mean, all that comes to mind. End of his first year, he's trying to get out of his contract. End of his second year, he's trying to get out of his contract. That's not a very cool thing to do.
He came from a very financially insecure situation. His father died when he was a freshman in college, and he almost quit college to go home then. He had four sisters and his mother. The older sister talked him into staying in Notre Dame. Even when he was in Notre Dame, as a student, he was doing things like sneaking out on weekends to box under alias names, which the university would never approve, to make money. It's smokers. He was running concessions for a pool thing, was legitimate in his dormitory. He was working. He was doing everything he could. He came from some financial insecurity, and I think when he had opportunities where people would reward him more significantly than Notre Dame would, he was certainly open to listening to him. And I'd add this Christy Walsh guy. I don't know how familiar you are with him. He was really the mover on the business deals behind Ruth and behind Gehrig and behind Rockne. And Walsh would tell him in Columbia, if you'll be in New York City, you know how much more we can do with you in New York City than we can do with you in South Bend, Indiana? Okay. We can make you a very wealthy man very, very quickly.
Wow.
But there was many forks in the road of him. Like he could have the post office, he could end up somewhere else. In Notre Dame, he could have ended up at Columbia. Okay. And even his travels, he could have not ended up on that flight. The more you dig into this guy, there were forks in the road many times, and history would have been greatly different. Oh, this is a his passport you put up. And when I got that, I didn't appreciate the full history of it. So I started digging. He got this passport in 1928 because there was an organized Newt Rockne tour to the Olympics. It was the first organized cruise tour to ever leave the United States. And it was organized under his name to take people leaving the United States that wanted to go to Europe and to see the Olympics in Amsterdam. And it literally was billed the Newt Rockne Olympic Tour. And this is what he got this passport for, and the stamps in it all indicate where he was from, England to Germany to the Netherlands. And it was all for that tour. And he wrote to somebody, he was going to make as much in that tour in a little over 2 weeks than he was going to make his whole summer on the lecture circuit and the coaching clinics. And that was $10,000. So he was going to make on this tour the same amount that Notre Dame paid him for his full year of employment with him.
5'8½". He seems shorter. What's it say for hair? Known?
Brown.
Oh, brown. Oh, okay.
Brown bald, brown dash
Brown,
bald.
bald.
And he played in for Notre Dame. He was the captain of the team in 1913.
My gosh. I love it. Blue eyes. Yeah, there you have blue eyes. All right. I love that passport photo. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's so unique. I mean, it's unbelievable. You only have one
Where
passport, you know.
did where did you get his passport?
That came from the family also. I picked it up in another deal a long time after that 1995 sale.
Oh, how interesting.
It's interesting the family saved all this stuff. It's very fortunate.
Yeah, no kidding. All
Okay,
right.
now this is interesting. This is his contract with Studebaker. Now, the younger people listening may not know what Studebaker is, but it was one.
look at the date on this.
It was a major automobile manufacturer in the country. And he signed this contract in March of 1931. He died 12 days after he signed this contract. And this contract was going to pay him $10,000 a year, the same amount Notre Dame was.
I thought that was pretty fascinating. Because I
And is
read the
it?
amount he was being paid on his contract, and I started seeing these, and I'm like, oh, that's good money. 800, 900, yep, 833. I see.
So what's a couple interesting things here. One interesting for me, this contract signed by a guy named Paul Hoffman, and I live in a house that once Paul Hoffman owned.
Oh,
But
wow.
as an aside, the chairman of Studebaker who put this deal together was a guy named Erskine. And Erskine had also been president of the Lay Board of Trustees at Notre Dame. And so I think that's the reason he didn't sign this contract. I don't think it was a secret, it was open. But he was kind of somewhat in a conflict because he'd been on the board for a long time at Notre Dame, but he wanted him Rockne involved with Studebaker, and so this contract was signed to pay Rockne the same amount while he was working for Notre Dame, both jobs. It says in this contract he wouldn't do anything here that interfered with his responsibilities as
And I love
coach.
this because I have a friend who puts on little concerts, and he's hired talent to come in and will pay them consulting fee to drop the name of the event as much as possible. And there's a contractual thing where it's like you'll do this many social media posts, you'll do this many interviews. So when I read this, where it's like it's understood you will continue to exploit Sudbaker or whatever extent feasible, radio talks, et cetera. So, I mean, they're saying when you're on the radio, you have to casually drop the name Studebaker,
Well, if you go to the website you referenced, I've got an audio recording on there of him giving a pep talk to Studebaker salesman.
Oh, you're kidding. Okay, I missed that.
And so that's kind of interesting. So, kind of a tale on this is that he dies in 1931 in May. The Rockne automobile, the model, comes out in late that year in 31.
Oh,
And an ad that comes out for it by Rockne Motors, which is a subsidiary of Studebaker. Erskine, who's the chairman of both corporations, says in that ad, it was Mr. Rockne's intention to leave his full-time coaching responsibilities at the end of the 31 season and become vice chairman of Rockne Motors.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And so that's it, the Rockne, Studebaker and Erskine. And those two guys, Rockne and Erskine, I'd mentioned, Rockne died 12 days after he signed that contract. And within 2 years, Erskine was dead. Also, he committed suicide. The depression had hit. Studebaker was going into receivership and he lost his personal wealth and he was under a lot of fire. So these two men who were the titans of their individual professional worlds were both dead in within a couple of years of the time they had done these deals. Nice.
Wow.
Yeah.
This piece you're showing now is the program from Notre Dame's first football game. And the football media guides and things for Notre Dame said they play a game in 1887, but they really didn't. They had a practice scrimmage thing with Michigan. Michigan came down to show them the game of football, and they put them through tutorial and drills, and then they played a little abbreviated 20-minute little mini game. The first real games then were in April of 88 when Michigan came back to play them twice on back-to-back days, and this is the program piece from that game. And that's the only piece of it, only one of its kind known to still exist.
Ooh, Newt. Wow. Newt Larson.
Because if you look at this, at the time it was like an intramural activity probably in some college. I mean, and so as they printed this out and passed it out to people as the rules of the game, you get, I think, 4 points for touchdown and the rules are different. And the players' names, and it was just a pass away, a pass out, toss away thing for people. It's amazing that one of them ever survived.
Right. I was just going to say that's beyond real. Unbelievable.
So that is the oldest piece of Notre Dame football memorabilia known to exist.
And where does it reside?
It resides with me.
Okay. Oh, I didn't mean like, sorry. Your personal collection was what I was after. Sorry. I don't mean to. I mean, I think all of us are the same. We, I don't like, you know what I mean?
Well, it isn't in my house where I am right now, but it's in my possession.
Yep. And I apologize. I didn't mean to.
Oh, it's okay. But it's like a Holy Grail type piece. I mean, of football history.
Yeah. Real quick question as we're winding down the show. When he died, what happened to I'm just curious, what happened to the family? Was he actually financially set for the wife to continue, or did she have to, you know, sell possessions or whatever? I don't know. I'm just curious.
No, she was okay. They bought a new house a year or two before. She got some royalties continued to come in, like from Wilson Sporting Goods. She got a few thousand dollars over a few years that continued to come because his name was on their products. Studebaker agreed to pay a royalty of 25 cents a car for every car with the Rockne name was on.
Wow.
And so that actually got her several thousand dollars, except then it went receivership and the Rockne model only lasted 2 years.
Right.
So I'm not sure how she ultimately did in later years, but she stayed in that same house until the end of her life, which was in like 1956 or 57.
Yeah. I read that too. Yeah. This was pretty interesting. I mean, most of us, you know the Gip from Ronald Reagan.
Yep. And Rockne's the one who really found Gip. Rockne was assistant coach on the team and Gip was came there to play baseball. And Rockne saw him out kicking a ball and reeled him in. And when Rockne became head coach, it was Gip's second year of playing and he put him right where he needed to be, which was anywhere he could touch the football. And and Gip became the real first true All-American that was recognized in any way.
All right, I got one last one that I thought was pretty interesting. Yeah, when I was grabbing these screenshots, I'm like, all right, I you know, we're not going to have enough time to share.
I would say anybody's interested in these images, there's a lot more if they go to the website. And it's Rockne, R-O-C-K-N-E, then and, and more, M-O-R-E.com. And you'll see a lot of things. This is, to me, the collector, this is spectacular, what you're showing. I just got this past year. This was his photo album.
Yeah.
and it was with the family until 1995. It just surfaced this past year, and I picked it
Photo
up.
of him on the beach.
Wow.
I
He,
love
yeah,
that
that's where
photo.
he met his wife working at Sandusky, Ohio, between his junior and senior year, and that's actually where he and Gus Dorai worked to perfect the forward pass. Dorai was working that summer also as a lifeguard there, and while they didn't invent it, they really perfected the use of the forward pass, which showed up in the fall of 1913, the Army game. They dazzled football of what they did with the forward pass, but they worked on it here while he was at the beach at Cedar Point.
Sandusky, Ohio. There's a really good brake pad manufacturer there.
So
Sorry.
anyway, it's great to
Tell
have. There's
me wrong reference.
many pictures in this photo album of him as a young man, which most people had never seen.
There's boxing, as you mentioned. I had no idea until you said that, that he did that. But I
Yeah,
mean,
he left campus to play some football games for pay and to box. He boxed under a name like Kid Williams. He had aliases, and he did it to make money.
yeah.
Well, you got
Ed,
to do.
we're almost out of time. Can you mention your book real quick and availability, if at all?
Yeah, I originally did this book for just some fellow collectors and friends and things who might have an interest in it. And it
I
got a little
will.
more interest. And so I updated it this past few months. And it
Let's see the
featured
whole
the
thing there, Andy. Let's see the whole
it,
book. I
it
love that
featured
title.
it features the images of the collection, and then I weave in some history or anecdotes that tie to them. I'm not set up in the book fulfillment business, but if anybody goes to the website and sends me a message, I'll find a way to get them a book and figure out how to do it. I've got a message thing you can send me, and you can actually, I've put it on the website. You can do the book page by page. You can flip through it and you can see what's in it and see if it's of
Oh,
interest to you.
nice. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. Andy, again, we're almost out of time. I think we should have
Impressive.
you on again, talk a little bit more about this incredibly historical collection of Newt Rockne. It's so underappreciated in the hobby right now, in my opinion. And I'm very thankful, and a shout out to Mike Mays, who led me to you and our contact, and to get you on the show and show this. This is just amazing, truly amazing.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to even spread the word a bit of the history of Mr. Rockne.
It's incredible, truly incredible. Andy, thanks for being on, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you,
So
gentlemen.
we're
Thank
down
you, Andy.
to 60 seconds, real quick, 2 minute warning. Handing off to you, what'd you pick up on tonight's show?
Again, Bob, every time we have an amazing guest like this on, who's gracious enough to share their passion, the hobby with us, I spent a couple hours yesterday doing a deep dive, and I mean, I don't know if you're the same, but we all know the story of Newt Rockne. I mean, amazing coach. I also didn't know he'd won back-to-back championships right before his death. Where it's just, so he was at the peak of his professional career. I mean, he had an amazing team. He had two back-to-back championships. He's regarded as one of the best coaches in college football, and a
And
tragic
that's part of the
end.
legacy that he died at his peak. I mean, that's
Yeah,
incredible, truly incredible
about
to
that,
you think.
back-to-back championships, and he dies. I mean, that's huge. I mean, so yeah, it's always really cool to just have a guest on who it takes a topic like this and does the deep dive. First of all, they're just doing the hobby, a favor by memorializing this stuff.
Right.
So, and it gives
I
me an opportunity to learn more about it. I love it.
agree 110%. It was just an incredible collection, incredibly preserved. We couldn't ask for anything more for the hobby. And that's what
Yeah.
it's all about. We're trying to preserve the hobby of a game that we all love and we know some of, but we're always learning. And in
That's
all
a great way to put
this hobby,
it.
which is a long time now, I continue to be amazed at the stuff I pick up and learn at the
But
same time.
you threw something out. You're like, I remember that 1995 auction, when they were auctioning off
I
books.
distinctly remember that because it was advertised as a I had bought from Dan over the years from a sports collector store.
You need to be careful dropping little tidbits like that, Bob. You're aging yourself.
Yeah, well, it is what it is, but
Yeah.
I do remember a lot of the hobby history, and again, I'm glad it's preserved to say the least. We're out of time. Thanks for watching and or listening. If you're listening to our podcast, then we'll be back hopefully next week with another show. Until that time, take care.
Hi, everyone. There's a new podcast in town, Statman and Robin. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history.
We have lots of stories to tell about the great and not so great teams and players in Baltimore's rich sports history, and some of the more obscure ones, too.
We grew up together with these teams and players, and we'll add our experiences to these great stories.
Yep, we were there for a lot of them. Join us here on the Sports History Network.